I'm standing at the reception area of the tiny airport in Porto Joffre, waiting for a 16-seater bush plane to land and take us to the southern Pantanal. Through the haze, we see the plane approach, land on the grass airstrip, and make a well-practiced U-turn to face the way it came. My stomach leaps with excitement. The last time I flew in a plane this size was to cross the famous Okavango Delta in Botswana. And now I was about to fly over an even bigger wetland. We said our goodbyes to Fred and boarded the plane. The hour-long flight was a true highlight of the expedition. The waterways expanded as far as the eye could see. A real-life painting of greens and blues dancing in synchrony across the landscape. As water levels lowered along the flight, large patches of cleared land began to appear. From the air, you could see the stark contrast between lush Pantanal vegetation and barren land demarcating a ranch. Admittedly, my feelings were torn seeing this. I had just spent a week in pristine habitat with so much life I could barely comprehend it. And then to see acres upon acres of cleared land in this ecosystem was difficult. But I knew some of these ranches were a large reason why the Southern Pantanal's wildlife still had a home. Nature tourism was growing significantly in the area. Our presence was proof, after all. Our plane gently descended and landed on a dirt airstrip in Miranda City. Waiting for us was a small welcoming party of two. Our driver and new guide, Lajanya. Lajanya is a tall, athletic woman with dark hair falling midway down her back, tucked underneath a Wild Source hat. We said our hellos, loaded into our transfer van, and hopped on the road. Since we couldn't check into our hotel for several hours, Chris arranged a visit at Proyecto Sulabra for lunch and a river cruise. After driving for 30 minutes and a quick stop at a rest station, we turned off of the main road and onto a dirt path. Lajanya hopped out several times to open cattle guards for our van to pass through. We were clearly in a mixed-use area. The vegetation looked wild and not managed by humans, but domestic livestock lived somewhere close. Was this our first encounter with a sustainable farm in the Pantanal? After about 10 minutes of weaving through Brazilian forest, we arrived at the project. We stepped out of the van and were hit with a wave of heat. This region was even warmer than the north. I thought to myself for the umpteenth time, isn't this supposed to be Brazilian winter? Why is it so dang hot? The gentle breeze did nothing to cool us down. I no longer questioned why fires had raged in the Pantanal for the preceding 3 years. The dry, hot air could easily fuel an inferno. We stepped inside a small, inviting presentation room and were greeted by an older gentleman in a worn-out t-shirt, well-used hat, and trousers made for working. This was the owner of Proyecto Sulabra and the visionary behind the farm today. We each took a seat to hear more about the ranch from our host. Lajanya was our interpreter. We learned that this farm was part of a biodiversity corridor program that played a crucial role in protecting the area's rivers, flora, and fauna. The corridor included several local municipalities, all with the goal of restoring and protecting the Sulabra and Miranda rivers. Fishing was prohibited amongst most of the corridor and highly regulated where it was allowed. Our host also showed several clips of endangered species caught on their mosaics of camera traps. We watched interesting footage of pumas, jaguars, and marsh deer, all living alongside their cattle, horses, and cultivated lands. After the presentation, we sat down for a delicious Brazilian-style farm-to-table lunch. Once we were done eating, we grabbed our cameras, bug spray, and sunscreen for a short river cruise. As we were loading into our transfer wagon, a group of locals from the morning tour came for lunch, and I quickly realized that some stereotypes are true. Let's just say the number of Speedos I've seen on men doubled in a day. Sorry, my American is hanging out right now. But tiny clothing aside, they looked like they were having a great time and had decided to spend their day at an eco ranch to swim and enjoy the river. I smiled. This area was more likely to stay wild if locals continued spending their time and money at locations like this.
And we're off.
Our driver fired up the tractor and we were off. We traveled along dusty roads until we reached the Salobra River. We piled into the canoes, noticeably a little more wobbly than our safari speedboat, and set off down the river. We were mildly entertained. After being in the heart of the Pensador for 7 days, our little canoe ride was admittedly a tad underwhelming. But we saw countless bird species, some of which were new, and we spooked a freshwater stingray. Pardon my ignorance, but I didn't even know freshwater rivers could have stingrays. It was a surprising encounter that I will surely not forget. After reaching the end of the river, we turned around and headed back upstream. We piled out of the canoe, climbed up into the wagon, and half bounced, half rode back to our transfer van to continue on our journey. By late afternoon, we had reached the next destination of our adventure, Fazenda San Francisco. Fazenda San Francisco is a 9,000-hectare ecotourism farm that specializes in cattle farming, rice cultivation, and nature tourism. If you recall from part one of this series and part two, 95% of the Pantanal is privately owned, meaning that protection of this critical habitat falls mostly in the hands of landowners. This fazenda was the perfect example of private landowners taking conservation into their own hands and becoming allies for wildlife. In addition to land protection, the owners have allowed scientific research on their land for over 2 decades. The ongoing project studied the lives of the fazenda's jaguars, endangered macaws, herpetofauna, and the highlight species of this portion of the adventure, ocelots. As we dropped our belongings in our rooms, we met back at the reception area for our first wildlife drive. Similar to the water-based portion of the trip, we were scheduled to embark on daytime and nighttime wildlife drives to observe land-dwelling species, thereby completing the picture of the full biodiversity of the Pantanal. Lajanya led us to a platform where we boarded our wildlife viewer. It was enormous. Designed to accommodate 20 people, these 4 diesel trucks converted into wildlife viewers were equipped with 5 rows of seats arranged auditorium style, complete with a roof to shield guests from the intense Brazilian sun. We had reserved the vehicle for private use, allowing us the freedom to pursue sightings without being constrained by annoying tour schedules. We said hi to our driver and spotter, then loaded onto our truck to see what was out and about. As the sky turned dark, the feel of the region changed. The air grew cooler, and the night seemed to burst into a full chorus of frog and insect songs. Not long after we reached the rice plantations, we found one, and then 2 crab-eating fox. I could tell from their similar size and body language that they were mates. The female was lactating, which meant that their den was somewhere nearby. I reflected on how many females we had seen lactating on this trip. This must be the prime birthing season for many species in the Pantanal. Both were on the move, looking for a meal, scanning the tall grasses and fence line for something edible. Then, much to our surprise, one of the foxes stopped, hopped, and came away with a prize toad.
Oh, got a frog.
Oh my gosh!
After the fox pair walked into the darkness, we continued on our night drive. Our next sighting was a true highlight, an ocelot. This individual was a male and traveling along the drainage ditch between the gravel road and rice plantations. Judging by his open wounds, he recently lost a fight or maybe 2. Was it also ocelot mating season? Did he challenge the local dominant male and lost? Maybe he won and mated with a local female, but not without a tough fight first. The longer we watched him, the more my questions about these cats started to accumulate. Like the nocturnal crab-eating fox beginning their nightly routine, this male was hungry and started searching for prey. He found something, stopped, began cocking his head to pinpoint the location of his victim, and then pounced. To our delight, he stood up with a big, fat rodent in his mouth. He gave it a good crunch, then began prepping his meal by peeling off its fur.
It's tearing off the fur right now.
Once he was satisfied with his hair-pulling job, he chewed and swallowed his prey, then went back to searching for food. It was late by this point, and we were ready to head back. Tomorrow would be a new day with new adventures in the Southern Pantanal. The following morning, we woke at sunrise for breakfast in our first daytime wildlife drive on the farm. After we finished our meal, we were introduced to the fazenda's resident ocelot biologist, Anhike, and wildlife veterinarian, Vanessa. The wild source has been supporting Anhike's research ever since Bill met him at San Francisco in the late 2010s. Since then, Anhike has aligned his ocelot field work with our trips so that we could be a part of the excitement. Not only were we going to observe Pantanal's land animals in the wild, but we were also going to learn about them from a scientific perspective. Being a biologist, I was stoked to meet Anhike and have our group join him in his field studies. Everyone grabbed their cameras and binoculars and loaded into the wildlife viewing truck. We left the reception area and headed east as the red-orange sun slowly made its ascent. Once we were beyond the cattle area, the vegetation greatly diversified and turned into a scene straight out of Jurassic Park. We had not encountered a landscape like this before. Towering wax palm trees rose high above the vegetation below. The ground was half submerged in water and blanketed in thick vines and bushes. The whole landscape was a vibrant green, as if Mother Nature turned up the green saturation dial. Lejani gave us more information about the protected region of the fazenda.
Here is the most preserved area of the farm because it's close to the river and it's connected to the lake, to the creek, San Domingos Creek. So this area stays under the water during the wet season.
Really?
So that's why they preserved that area because it's not possible to use, to manage. And here in Brazil, we have a law that you must preserve 20% of your land. If you have a farm, it depends on the biome where you are. Here is 20%. You have to preserve that. You cannot touch, you cannot put animals or anything. So that's
let it grow.
Yeah, just let it go. Yeah, grow.
How high does the water get in the wet season here?
Oh, to here.
Really?
It's all flooded, yeah.
Oh, wow.
There's some areas in Pantanal where it gets completely dry, like very bad dry, and then during the wet season it's 3 meters of water, four
wow.
meters, which is like 10 feet.
A lot of water.
12 feet.
It's amazing.
Yeah. And that's here, they used to have, here in this farm, they use around 4,000 hectares here. So they used to plant rice, flooded rice, and corn. Now they just have rice and just a little part of the farm. You're gonna see many of those channels all over the place. You're gonna be driving around those dikes. And this is how they manage, used to manage to throw the water to the rice plantation.
Irrigation?
Yes. Yes.
So, not so much corn though. You don't see much corn.
Not anymore. They
Why?
Used to have, they used to do a rotation a while ago, like soybean and corn. Mm. Soybean and corn. But this area, they used to rent to somebody else to plant. They just have cattle and horses here and tourists, and they used to rent the land to somebody else to plant rice. Now it's their own area, but 200 hectares que plantou esse ano, né?
De arroz?
É.
Sim.
100 hectares, just only 100 hectares of rice. And where it used to be rice, they are letting the grass to grow to put cattle, which is much better here. It's less impact than a crop, for example, in Pantanal area. So because of that, you're gonna see many of channels, artificial ones, which was built many years ago. So they pump water from the river and from the rain. Because of that, a lot of animals come, a lot of birds. So that's why here is a very nice hot spot to see wildlife, because there's food and shelter for them. So they feel comfortable around. We're gonna be seeing some of those. There's a main pump close to the Miranda River, and they manage those, like open the channel, close the channel. That's how they manage the crop here.
As we continued driving, Onhike explained the differences in ecotones found in this region and why there's such an abundance of wildlife.
This area here, you can see the relief is a little bit, there's some relief because the Pantanal is very flat. So here we are in the ecotone of Pantanal and Cerrado, so it's where the two biomes meet. It's exactly, if you look on the Brazilian system of biomes, we are driving almost on top of the division line of Cerrado and Pantanal. So this is like a piece of Cerrado inside of the Pantanal. So this type of environment has some more biodiversity because you have two biomes meeting, so species of both of them. So that's why not only pampas cat, but this area you might see different carnivore maned wolf. So it uses this area. Giant anteaters, they are more common on these higher grounds. Some of the armadillos are more common. And then when we look that way, we can see very well, but that starts to get flat. It's when you enter the Pantanal. In that area, it's where the ranch started the agriculture area. So a portion of the Pantanal area was transformed for agriculture, and another portion which is going from our right, far right, all over around, is where you have the native Pantanal. So for you guys to have an idea what would be the, because this landscape has been changing since 75. So the natural vegetation of where we are now is like this, you see these islands of forest? So these are just fragments of the original forest from almost 50 years ago. So this has been changed to open pastures for cattle. So this is a very typical scene of central Brazil. So you have some long wilderness areas that have been cleared for pastures for many, many years.
So that's a lot of good grass out here for the cattle.
Yeah, that's very good. Because they deforested, put the pasture, and that's the main, because the main economy in the Pantanal is cattle raising. And some areas of the Pantanal, because here's the border, right? In the border, you used to have some of these big forests, so they had to clear more. In the plains, you have a lot of natural grasslands as well, especially where because imagine the Pantanal is very, very flat, but there's some relief. Where it's a little bit lower, the flood lasts longer, and you don't have forest there because most of the trees don't support. Yeah, they cannot live there, so you just start having grasslands. That's so when you see an image from high from the Pantanal, normally you're gonna see a lot of open grasslands and some forest. Forest is normally where the ground is 1 meter higher already. It's enough for the flood to behold.
After driving for 30 minutes scanning for wildlife, we stopped at a bend in the road and got out to follow Onhike and Vanessa. They were taking us to the location of one of their live traps to show us how they set them up for capturing ocelots. Onhike gave us further information.
Why we're putting here, but you remember that, so the Coricho, this kind of river is just there.
Yeah.
So this forest, this is kind of ocelot prime habitat. A little bit disturbed, but it's good because they like to travel on routes and roads like that. So what we do is we find a shaded area, because this is sometimes the hardest part to capture them, is to find suitable areas for traps, because sometimes in the open areas they're moving, there's a lot of density of them, but you don't find a good spot. It's very hard because we have to be worried with the heating, because we will open the trap by the end of the day and we'll check in the morning. Very early in the morning we check all the traps. But because there are several traps, some of them will be later in the morning when we finally get. So it's important to find these shady areas to avoid the heat. But one thing that we always try to do is like open a little trail, like with a knife, because once we set the trap, to also help luring the cat.
Yep, lure.
We use some bacon. So you're gonna, from here you can see one of the tree trunks is kind of brownish. That's a lot of bacon that we've been spreading around. Well, inside we tie a chicken leg. We fry it just to get it to last more in the bush. And we also use like a really nasty juice of sardines. And we keep doing all the trail. So I'm explaining all that because normally we try to be just very few people in the trail so we don't hit our scent. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So if you don't mind to wait, we're just going to set the trap there and we come back.
After the demonstration, we continued on our wildlife drive while Anhike and Vanessa checked the live traps. For the next 3 days, we went out every morning and evening to spot wildlife. We saw flocks of greater rhea, the largest bird in South America. Similar to Africa's ostrich, greater rheas are flightless with gray-brown plumage. They look like a small cousin to their bigger African counterparts and seemed right at home on the fazenda, walking through both rice plantations and wild grasslands. Remarkably, on multiple occasions throughout our drives, we saw groups of marsh deer, which is unusual for the species as I've come to learn. Marsh deer are mostly solitary, but are found in great numbers on the farm due to the abundance of food, protection from conflict with humans, and access to mates. We even spotted a buck showing off and making himself look extra sexy for a resident female. Probably the most exciting sighting during a daytime drive was with two jaguarundis. Anhike and I were deep in conversation when all of a sudden we both, at the exact same time, caught the flash of two black bodies moving through the tall grasses. In hushed voices, we relayed the message to Lajania and our driver to stop immediately. In case you've never heard of these cats, jaguarundis are odd-looking, utterly fascinating small felines. They weigh up to 16 pounds and possess long, slender bodies, flat heads, and exceptionally long tails. They resemble weasels more than typical cats. Unlike ocelots, jaguarundis have adapted to be active during the day, a rare trait among small felines. I found several jaguarundi tracks in Costa Rica, but never successfully spotted an individual. So you can imagine my surprise when we saw not one, but two jaguarundis. The first cat dashed away from our vehicle without looking back, while the other stopped and began calling for the other one. Looking through my camera lens, I could tell that the calling cat was young. The one that ran off must have been its mother, and this kitten was calling for her to come back. Its confusion afforded us with a once-in-a-lifetime sighting. Anhike was just as excited as me. Of all the years he had been studying wildlife on the fazenda, he had barely seen any jaguarundis. I was sure to send him my photos after the experience. We saw countless other species during our drives, including two types of snakes, countless new bird species, a six-banded armadillo, and a tapir. Tapirs are another unique species and look like a hodgepodge mix of an elephant, a pig, and a rhino. I'm not joking. Similar to elephants, they raise their proboscis noses out of the water as they swim. They are also massive creatures capable of reaching weights up to 800 pounds. As obligate herbivores with considerable size, they play a vital role in the seed dispersal of native vegetation, particularly large seeds that other species cannot consume. However, due to deforestation and conflicts with humans, their numbers are declining, raising concern among conservationists working to restore natural habitats. How will forests regenerate if their primary seed disperser is wiped out or significantly reduced in number? Despite these concerns, the excitement of seeing one in the wild, doing what it does best, swimming, temporarily pushed such thoughts aside. It was a truly special moment. Now that we had seen Anhike's work and observed an ocelot in the wild, we wanted to learn more about the cats. Luckily for us, Anhike gave an hour and a half presentation all about his work. Don't worry, I won't share the whole thing with you, although I did record the whole thing. But I want to give you some highlight information from the talk. First and foremost, what are ocelots?
So the ocelot, which is the Latin name is Leopardus pardalis, is what we call a medium-sized cat. So it's way bigger than house cats, but way smaller than what we call the large cats. And they have a kind of wide distribution, a geographic distribution. So they are found from southern Brazil and northern Argentina, all over Brazil, most of countries of South America, Central America, and they go up to portions of Mexico. And there is this tiny little population in Texas, United States, with something like 50 individuals. So when we see a map like that, we think, oh, there's ocelots all over. So this is the potential distribution or their natural distribution, but it doesn't mean that they are abundant everywhere, or not even that they are still in most of these areas, just to give an idea that this species has this big flexible areas from equator to tropical and some upper tropical areas. So it distributes through different types of rainforest to shrubland and xeric environments. I always like to talk a little bit to explain a bit of the ecology of ocelots, start looking at their difference between males and females. So when animals, they have males and females are distinct from each other, that we can tell them apart just by looking, we say they have a sexual dimorphism. So ocelots are a very good example of a species with sexual dimorphism, because females are normally almost 25% smaller than males. So these are some numbers of the animals that we have captured around. So the females, they weigh in average 9.4 kilos, while males are weighing average 12.3 kilos. So there's a big difference. Of course, males, as you have been able to see with your own eyes, they have this very conspicuous testicles, so it's easy to tell them apart. About the activity of the animal, this is a nocturnal crepuscular animal. So most of the chances that we have to see ocelots active, at least, would be in sunrise and sunset. This is a frequency graph, that's why the peak is so high, but that's the two points where you have better chances, but they are sometimes active during the day. So it's just to get an idea that, unlike if you get a jaguar, look at a jaguar, his graph is very different. You have a lot of activity during daytime. So jaguars, you have chances of, real chances of seeing them during the day. Ocelots, if you see one during the day, is like really, really unusual, because they put most of their activity at when it's dark. Why is that? Because most of what they eat is active at night, or not most of what they eat, but their main prey, what they look for, is active at night. But ocelots, they're amazing hunters because they can hunt from small mammals, small lizards, even frogs and toads, to some big mammals like brocket deers. I don't know if you know brocket deers. It's a deer about one adult, about this size. I have recorded rheas being preyed by male ocelots. So probably when rheas, they sleep at night lying down on the ground with the neck on top of the body, that's probably when they manage to get on their neck and kill it. But normally, ocelots, they go mainly for small mammals, so either rodents or marsupials. So this is like their, what we would say in Brazil, their rice and beans for every day, it's the small mammals. So what is the prime habitat for ocelots? So this is normally considered a forest cat. So that's why they supposedly they have the spots, is a way to blend in the environment. Of course, when we see them and we are looking at them, we can see them well, but when they start moving through the bushes, I think you even with the spotlight, we could see that sometimes they just kind of vanish in the vegetation. So normally they are more connected to the forest, which means that they need forests inside their home ranges, their territories, but not all of it. needs to be forest. It's important to have forest, but not all of it.
We had witnessed Anhike's scientific endeavors firsthand, but what inquiries was he looking to answer, and what revelations had he unearthed during his extensive study of the species?
So, again, we come back to the ranch, and we can ask why we came to study this forest cat in an area that's so much disturbance and so much open air. It's because we started to have high rates of wildlife sightings, and ocelots is one of the most sighted species, and we have sightings. This is rice field. That's a female that had a cub right into one of these culverts that drain water from the field. So it's like completely artificial environment. And this is just to give you an idea that along this 18 years, 80% of the night drives you spot ocelots. So it's like really amazing. Something very different is going on. So we started to study here. And our main hypothesis is that these rice fields, they are attracting a lot of rodent. So increase the rodent population that would increase predator population. So not if you have a look when you are going by, at night we're looking for ocelots, but during the day, pay attention to how many raptor birds that you can see. So there's an increase of animals that rely on this type of prey. So we have from artificial land, let's say artificial, but human land to natural areas. How this density, does it vary? There are more ocelots in artificial area, in the forest, it's all the same. What's going on? So that's one of the main things that we are trying to find out. And to do that, we use the camera trap. So our camera trapping season lasts normally from mid-September to mid-December, more or less. We are using 60 stations in the field. So each station has two cameras facing each other. And we set those stations 800 meters from each other. Normally, we make two blocks of 30 stations. So we stay 2 months with 30 stations in one area, then we move 2 months later to the other block, and then we analyze everything as one. So pretty much we set the camera traps, they're collecting data. When we come back, we start to trial those camera traps, and we're gonna, let's say, separate ocelot pictures, and through the pictures, we'll start the identification process. So ocelots, they have unique markings on their fur, which is like human fingerprints. So we can use that to identify different individuals. And the reason why we use two cameras in one station is because the right side and left side are not the same. The pattern is very similar, but the design is not. So it's important to have both sides to be sure which individual you have. But we have a big collection of data here it's our database is from 2010 up now. So we have more than 4,000 records of ocelots around, and we have identified more than 65 individuals toward this period. We have three times more females than males. So the density of females is way higher than males. This is kind of expected for ocelots because they are solitary. And males, they have way bigger home ranges than females. So let's say they're in one area, it fits more females than males, if I could say something like that. In our campaign of 2019, the last 60-point grid that we did, we have recorded 43 different individuals, and it translated to a density of almost 47 ocelots for every 100 square kilometers, which is considered a high density. The average density of ocelots in its distribution is something like 20. Of course, you have areas much higher and areas very low, but this is above the almost double the average. So it's a good ocelot area. So again, those curves is just another thing was interesting is that although males and females, they have the same chances of being recorded close to, in their center of activity, the males, they move farther. So they are recorded in much more traps than females. So males are normally between 6, 7, and 10 different stations they're moving by. Females are maybe 3 or 4. So again, it translates to small home ranges, and males, they're overlapping probably 3-4 different females.
What about the battered male we had seen a couple times on wildlife drives? What was the mating strategy of these cats?
Because these are solitary animals, and once in a while they have to get together to mate. So what happened is that a female on heat, she stays on heat for about a week, and for that week she will try to mate. So she starts to leave scent in an area that she's moving more. She kind of shortens her movement around where she's more active there, and she starts peeing. I'm not sure if that's the correct word to say, but peeing, pooping, scratching, meowing. So she's doing a lot of a racket because she has 1 week to try to mate and have a possibility of gestation. So she starts to call and call, and normally she will attract attention of males that are moving by. They pick the scent, they hear, and they will get close. And then you have sometimes 2, 3, even 4 different males getting to where the female is. And that's where you have a dispute. They're going to have to dispute that female. So these disputes can be very intense. So this is kind of my suspicions of what is going on with the male that you guys saw in these two last night, because he has some wounds. Brooke told me that he has some, looks like some puncture marks, so it might be a bite. And it's not the type of wounds caused by a predator, because the only thing that would prey on an ocelot around here would be either a jaguar or a puma. And if they managed to put puncture marks in the skull of an ocelot, the guy wouldn't be moving around trying to eat, so he would be dead. So that's why we think it might be even another ocelot bite and fight. They have a gash in the leg. So these disputes are very intense. And normally what happens? These males, they will try to push the other male away, stay with the female, and try to mate with her the most they can to be able to produce a young with her. And when her heat is over, he keeps going to his life, try to find another female. So if we think as strategies of reproduction, we can say that males are going for numbers, like quantity, and females are going for quality. Another thing that we managed to do with our work is understanding cause of mortality. So for instance, this female, we have recorded her in 2018, October. 2 weeks later, we found her roadkill on the highway. So this is the main source of mortality of ocelots around here. So although they are protected, they are not hunted, they are not persecuted inside the ranch, there's a big highway on the southern portion where animals are always, well, vulnerable to collisions with car. Actually, 2020, there was another female that we had records being killed in the highway. So it's an important source.
Back out on our night drive, we spotted the same male 2 more times, and each time he looked more battered than before. He now had a deep gash on the inside of his back left leg and open wounds across his face. He was panting hard, but walking okay, and successfully hunting. The ocelot team decided to let nature take its course and not to intervene. If this male was meant to survive, he'd find a way to carry on. And he successfully captured him on his camera traps, and who knows, maybe he'll show up again for us next season. Our very last day on the Fazenda was the most exciting of all. There were 2 important species that eluded us until the final wildlife drive. The west side of the Fazenda was covered with termite mounds, the perfect food source for giant anteaters. If you've never seen a giant anteater before, they look like something straight out of a sci-fi movie. They have wildly extended mouths that barely open, crazy long sticky tongues that lap up insects, and a tail equal in length to their bodies with shaggy fur that touches the ground. Their eyes and ears are tiny, but what they lack for in eyesight and hearing, they make up for with smell. San Francisco is known for its population of giant anteaters, but somehow we had gone our entire visit without spotting one, and trust me, we were looking. Our driver turned left off of the farm's main road into a cow pasture that was packed with termite mounds. Driving to the back of the fence line, there, right before our very eyes, we found a giant anteater. Stepping out of the truck, we followed at a safe distance, downwind and out of its range of smell. After 10 minutes on the ground, the giant anteater stepped through a barbed wire fence and walked up into the brush on the other side of the pasture. We hopped back into our truck and resumed our drive. After traveling for 15 minutes, we abruptly stopped at a culvert brimming with water. This man-made waterway, teeming with native vegetation and wildlife, marked the boundary between the wild, untamed part of the fazenda and the rice plantations. Approximately a quarter mile away from us, our spotter caught sight of something large with two eyes positioned at the front of its head, a jaguar. She was so far away that I had to snap a few photos of her through my camera to make out her form. Slowly, she traversed along the culvert bank in our direction, clearly on the hunt. We sat quietly as she made her approach. It was pitch black outside, the only light coming from flashing fireflies dancing above the pastures. To ensure we didn't lose the female jaguar, our spotter intermittently turned on his light, searched for the female, then turned the light off again. Closer and closer she came. The air was eerily quiet. And then, as she reached the ditch at the end of the culvert, our spotter turned on his light and the jaguar was leaping forward in our direction. My heart leapt out of my chest. With our poor nighttime eyesight, we failed to notice the capybara directly in front of us in the ditch below, the very creatures she was stalking. The capybaras emitted their predator warning calls, alerting others of the hungry cat's presence.
She's a mother. She's a mother.
This female was massive. I mean, huge. She was significantly bigger than any of the jaguars we had seen in the north. Her teats were swollen, a common theme amongst the female mammals along this trip. She left her cubs in the hidden location while she went off to feed. And judging by her size, her cubs were not going to have any problems with malnourishment. Jaguars, endangered marsh deer, vulnerable macaws, rarely seen small cats, untouched wilderness, agricultural pastures, and livestock all living harmoniously on one piece of land. Fazenda San Francisco proved to me that coexistence is possible. Nature and people were thriving here, so much so that the farm was restoring portions of the rice plantations back to their natural state. Places like this need to be celebrated and used as a global example of predator-friendly beef production, sustainable tourism, and conservation. Thanks for listening to this four-part series, In Search of Jaguars, A Journey Through the Poncinelle on Rewildology. This expedition was recorded in August 2023 with The Wild Source, a wildlife biologist-owned safari company that is disrupting the industry through empowerment. If you'd like to join me on The Wild Source's 2024 expedition to the Poncinelle, either head on over to thewildsource.com, check out the link in the show notes, or reach out to me directly and I'll happily send you more information. I've been asked if there will be a video version of this series, and I'm excited to report that yes, I will be creating a corresponding YouTube series showcasing this expedition. Be sure to sign up for the Rewildology newsletter to learn when the video series will drop and stay up to date on the show's happenings. Special thanks to Fred Crema, Abby Martin, Kristen Douglas at Pure Brazil, Bill Givett at The Wild Source, Anhike, and the guests on the 2023 expedition, and all of our hosts throughout Brazil for making this adventure possible. If you enjoyed this series, please share it with a friend and tag Rewildology on social media with your thoughts. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, please consider leaving a 5-star rating or a review and let others know what you think about the series. If you'd like to help keep these stories on the airwaves, please consider making a monetary donation at rewildology.com or purchasing a piece of swag to show off your Rewildology support. A portion of every sale and donation are given to the show's conservation partners. If you're a business owner and would like to sponsor a future conservation expedition series, please reach out to me directly and we'll chat about the possibilities. Before I let you go, don't forget to get out in nature, even if it's just your own backyard or a park up the street. Every wild space is precious, near or far. If you do have the opportunity to travel abroad, consider staying at an eco lodge, visiting a national park, or supporting a local NGO working to preserve the environment. You won't believe how far your seemingly small act of support will go. All right, friends, this is Brooke signing off. Remember, together we'll rewild the planet.